Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review podcast. Our guest today is Catherine Kraft. We'll continue our conversation by talking more about the work of the sculptor Melvin Edwards. I wanted to sort of take a step back, and I imagine that your research in the book on Neo-Dada might have helped set the stage for your interest in ARP, and then I wanted to ask you, well, about kind of the origins of the book, or how you started or conceived this project on Neo-Dada and abstract expressionism, to go back.
Yeah, that really goes back, because yeah. it goes back to my dissertation topic.
Yeah.
Although the book became so different that I think there's only maybe two out of a dozen chapters that overlap with the dissertation. And the way I got to the dissertation topic, I think, really continues to feed the work that I do. I really wanted to write a dissertation on a topic on surrealism.
Uh-huh.
And so I spent a summer, kind of reading and looking for a topic and reading stuff. And I was reading at some point older catalogs, things like Alfred Barr's Fantastic Art, Dada Surrealism, and Robert Motherwell's The Dada Painters and Poets. And I kept noticing, it's almost like static or interference when you're getting a radio station or something. I kept getting little flickers of their present moment.
Uh-huh.
Like there'd be references to what was going on in art that was contemporary to them.
Uh-huh.
And I started getting kind of curious about why this was happening, why this was being seen in terms of their present rather than looking at it as their past.
Yeah.
And in talking about it and thinking about it and then discussing it with my advisor, there sort of came the idea of like, well, maybe that's a good topic. Maybe that's worth delving into. That's kind of where it started, like looking at this period. And originally I was trying to cast the net a lot wider and have it be kind of the 40s through the 60s and be Dada and surrealism. And I started working on Dada and it became so big that the surrealism kind of dropped out. Right. And by the time I finished my dissertation, and this is what I always tell people who are writing dissertations, tell students that, I said, if you're lucky, by the time you get to the end of your dissertation, you'll know what you really want to write about.
Right.
And you just get the dissertation done and then you can kind of do what you want. And by the time I had finished my dissertation, I had found a couple of sources that I wasn't able to delve into that was really from back in the 40s. Mainly, I found a couple of uses of the term Neo-Dada like way back around 1950, 51, referring to Pollock's work.
Huh.
And that kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
And so the book kind of started with trying to answer that question of like, what did that... Because one of the things I've found or felt I found in my dissertation is that Neo-Dada in the 50s and 60s, when it started to be used to describe the work of artists like Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg and Cy Twombly, it really wasn't helpful to treat it as if it were some kind of historical term created by historians.
Right.
It was something that kind of circulated in gossip, and it was kind of a criticism.
Huh.
And the historical stuff kind of accrued to it as it gained currency.
Yeah.
As other people kind of outside this conversation started trying to make sense of it. And so a lot of the work I did early on was in trying to figure out what did people think Dada was and how were they using it to hold, contemporary art accountable through the use of this term Neo-Dada. And so ARP kind of figured in that early research.
Yeah.
And he came to figure in the research that fed into the book.
Yeah.
The other thing that fed into the book was my dissertation was largely kind of historiographic. It was like a survey of criticism and art reviews and of the time and things like that. And I really wanted to write about objects and write about all artists. And so I kind of consciously set out with the book to try to do those two things. And what I got to and where those things came together was in writing about artists who were also functioning as critics and historians. Mm-hmm. Robert Motherwell's work as an editor on the Dawn of Painters and Poets was really key, I think, to the way Dada was received in the United States, and it was shaped by his own artistic concerns, and at the same time it also had an impact on his own artistic concerns. And what you were talking about with Duchamp earlier, you know, at the exact same time Duchamp is also trying to take steps to kind of ensure his artistic legacy, at the same time that a new movement is a moving and is emerging in art that he really doesn't like at all.
right. But there's so many different kind of interesting angles to it. I thought about how there's a lot of times if you learn about, I guess, some of the dominant figures of the 40s and 50s, they're such a in terms of the history, you might learn that at that time there was such a focus on painting as a medium and abstraction, whether it's Clement Greenberg or kind of Alfred Barra and William Rubin and kind of like Cezanne and then Picasso, and it's all of these questions about, you know, what is painting and what is painting for and how painting is the central thing. But then by focusing on Motherwell, I mean, who is a painter, but there's all this other aspects to it. And I guess you point out that the phrase Dada painters might be almost sort of paradoxical, but Dada was important to him and to people who he was working with in a way that these other people didn't recognize necessarily.
Yeah, I think even in that period, there Dada has several different meanings, depending on who's talking about it and when. Even Motherwell, I think, was very conflicted about Dada.
Yeah.
He really despised its destructiveness,
but
he really appreciated the kind of ethical position that led them, or led some of them, to be that anti-art about everything. And I think that's also one of the most interesting things about working on Dada, that in some ways, because Dada was a movement that was really so much in protest against what at that time of the early 20th century was, you know, one of the most horrible wars yet to occur, in that regard, it became a real touchstone, a point of reference, both for its sort of ethical purity, but also for its failures for this later generation also going through a world war. I think also because Dada kind of got thrown around and used to label all kinds of experimental things, as you said, well beyond painting. The same thing kind of happens with the term neo-Dada, where it becomes the term of choice for all these really interesting and exciting developments in the art world that don't have names at first. Because in addition to the work of artists like Rauschenberg and Johns, you know, pop art is initially called neo-Dada. Early forms of minimalism and happenings and installation art and conceptual art, they all at some time or another get this little... get this label bestowed upon them.
I'd heard previously the term in the context of Rauschenberg and Johns, but I had no idea of the kind of breadth that you're describing. But so then another transition in the same period in the Melvin Edwards' work, whose retrospective, mm-hmm. 5 decades you created a couple of years ago, an artist who had some years in New York, but has also, he's been in different places. And I wanted to start by asking a little bit about his background and kind of his early years. And I read in your catalog that he'd been a very serious and talented football player as a kid, and I thought that's sort of interesting because we often have these stereotypes that the artists and the football players are sort of different people. But then I thought, well, you know, like Matthew Barney was also a football player, and mm-hmm. I wonder, like, I think you quoted Edwards that the kind of grace and athleticism, and I can't remember the details, that somehow the physicality and the coordination and beauty of football was important for him. But I guess my question would just be, just how your interest in his work developed and how it fits into the other work that you've done.
Yeah, initially, I had a couple of different opportunities to see Edwards' work. I first became familiar with it really when I was working on a permanent collection installation at the Metropolitan Museum, which was before I came to the Nasher. And this was a show that we called Paper Trails, and it was artists who worked with paper as a material rather than just as a support. And they had a couple of works by Edwards that we included, and in the process of working on that show and doing didactics, and I was looking into his sculptures, and I hadn't really been very familiar with his work. And at that point, I don't think he'd really had, or I wasn't aware, which is probably more likely, that he'd had an exhibition recently. And shortly after I joined the Nasher, I made a trip to Los Angeles where I saw this incredible exhibition called Now Dig This,
right.
Which is Black Art in Los Angeles from the 60s to 1980, I think.
Yeah.
And he was a prominent part of that exhibition, and it really blew me away. And what really moved me about his work is you know, because of the work I had already done on mid-century American art, I was really quite familiar with the syntax and technique of welded metal sculptures.
Right.
I knew it from, you know, of course, from David Smith and, you know, back further, Gonzalez, and slightly more recently, that of John Chamberlain or Richard Stankiewicz. So, yeah, there's this lineage that this artist is supposed to fit into. But I felt like I was seeing work that was... It fit, but it didn't fit.
Yeah.
It was like taking this kind of language and using it to very different means.
Uh-huh.
It was really concentrated. It used scale in a way that I hadn't seen before.
Uh-huh.
And having just joined the Nasher Sculpture Center, my first thought was, wouldn't it be amazing to present some of that work there?
Yeah.
And I had largely been an independent scholar up till then. I mean, I had worked in museums at different times, but I think I was somewhat naive in some ways and to my own. And sometimes that being naive is good because my first thought was like, oh, there must be somebody organizing a show of this work. Cause I remembered from the previous research I'd done that there'd been a retrospective in 1993. And I thought somebody's bound to be doing a survey. So maybe we can become a venue.
Right.
And I went to talk to his dealer on a trip to New York and found out nobody was doing that. And it just sort of struck me that I could, we could do this.
Yeah.
You know, if the artist wanted us to do that. And so I met him and we talked about it. And that was sort of the genesis of that project. And, it's something that, first of all, it was just a tremendously rewarding experience. Yeah. It was terrific to, and I feel very privileged to have spent as much time with an artist of such thoughtfulness and intelligence and talent as Melvin Edwards. And I was also really happy to be able to present that, to present the work in the Nasher.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that was interesting to me and sobering, and it also demonstrates to me sometimes the difference between academic work and museum work, and that's not very good. It's not a very good distinction, but in writing a book like An Audience of Artists, which was published by an academic, a university press,
yeah.
I'm on the one hand very interested in how stories get told, like the stories we know about history or the canon or how that gets made. And so in that book, I really focused on canonical artists, Marcel Duchamp, Robert Motherwell, Jackson Pollock, Barnett Newman. Those were the four main artists in that book. And occasionally people ask me if I would like to make an exhibition out of that book.
Right.
I thought, well, would I really want to do that?
Right.
And I've always thought that it wouldn't be such an interesting exhibition. And I still think that. But I think part of that, part of the reason for that, though, is that when it comes to the presentation of shows in museums, there are still so many different stories to be told.
Right, right.
And that feature artists who are not already part of the stories we already know.
Yeah.
So I guess I see it as like two sides of the same project. One is that you have to investigate how things got to be the way they are.
Yeah.
And then you have to also try to see what you want to, how you want to change that. And it can't just be a matter of adding to it.
Yeah.
It has to be in conversation with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's been important to me about the work I did on the Melvin Edwards retrospective, is that it was, I think, for me, and I kind of personally or selfishly, it was a chance to exercise that other aspect of what I think has to be part of a larger historical project.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Sure. No, definitely. Yeah, I can. Yeah. I thought it was interesting that, I guess around 1970, his exhibition at the Whitney Museum in New York, that there were calls for Black artists in particular to commit to like kind of explicitly militant kinds of work, but he and there were artists like Edwards and Frank Bowling and others who said, who were still interested in abstraction along with social relevance and social concern. And it seems like Edwards, there's always been this balance of different aspects to it. You can just look at it as out of an interest in welded steel as a medium and David Smith and so on and so forth, or you can reflect on the social realities he's talking about, and that combination seems really powerful.
I think that's one of the strongest aspects of his work, and I think it is characteristic of a small circle of artists who he knew at that time. I'm also thinking, I think Jack Whitten operated the same way, that, you know, you would start talking to one of them about social meaning of their work and they would switch gears on you and start talking about the formal the formal properties, and vice versa.
Right.
I think it was an extraordinarily challenging time anyway.
Yeah.
But I think artists in their positions must have felt really pulled in a lot of different directions.
Right.
And the ones who were really good
were
able to somehow fuse it together into works that are really that operate on multiple levels,
yeah,
in ways that are really, I don't know, just really stimulating and really, yeah, satisfying.
Yeah, I guess the example of the his use of barbed wire, as you know, there's in Texas there's barbed wire and ranches, and I learned in the catalog that his farmhouse in New York there was barbed wire around there, but then of course at the same time the much more kind of menacing and sinister, whether lynching or concentration camps or it seems like he I guess it's like the specific meanings are there, especially with the title of the whole series called Lynch Fragments, that makes it completely explicit that what the pointing to a specific social history, but somehow, I guess, as you're saying, the form of the work isn't kind of didactic. It's not, mm-hmm. he's not trying to narrate a specific event, but work in a more kind of connotative or suggestive way. It's really, really interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's not a question either. But the question,
all right.
My question is, it sounds like, I guess in the 70s and 80s, there were a number of African-American artists and others who were interested in traveling to Africa and visiting Africa for the first time and learning something. But it was very interesting to me that Edwards he's made kind of a long-term permanent presence there, and he's done years of serious work there, and there have been elements in his own work. You know, it's not just kind of a tourist thing, but it's become a major part of his work. So could you talk about kind of what role Africa or his time and his work, what role that plays in his mm-hmm. work?
I think it's terrifically important to him and has been a mainstay in his work almost from the beginning. One of the things that was educational for me, among many things, was learning from him that even in the 60s, even before he went to Africa for the first time, I think in 1970, but you know, there were African American publications that also carried articles about what was going on in other parts, yeah, of the world, in, yeah, African, you know, what was struggles for independence and liberation in African countries were very much seen,
yeah,
in parallel with the civil rights movement,
sure,
in the United States. And so,
yeah,
people who were interested about these things had information was accessible to people,
yeah,
who were interested in these topics. I think something that really contributed to Edwards' involvement in Africa was his relationship with his second wife, Jane Cortez, who was a really important poet,
yeah,
and writer, who was also very connected with and interested in Africa.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they traveled there together, I think, I think the establishing of a house in Senegal was, you know, a decision on both, something they were both,
yeah,
interested in pursuing. And I think for Edwards in particular, being being somebody who works with welded metal,
yeah,
I think he sees himself very much in the line of a tradition with blacksmiths.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a very strong tradition of that in parts of Africa. And that's been something I think he's really sought out and pursued,
yeah,
when he's been there.
Yeah.
And he had a Fulbright in 1989, 1990 to work in, I think, in Zimbabwe, and made tremendous work there and also taught. He's a very gregarious person.
Uh-huh.
It feels like wherever you are, you will meet somebody who has some connection,
wow,
to Melvin,
yeah,
Edwards. But that's really helped him in, I think he feels very connected to Africa in ways that are, you know, they're genuine and that they're rooted,
yeah,
in really engagements with real people and real places. And those are also people who, you know, travel to the United States. They travel to New York, where he's been based since the late 60s.
Yeah. Well, let me just close by asking if you could tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on or what's coming up.
It's been funny since The Nature of Art opened at the Nasher, and people say, well, what's next? Uh-huh. Well, what's next is The Nature of Art.
Yes,
because
yes.
It's, yeah. It is opening at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice in April, and I'll be going over in a little under 2 months to oversee the installation, and I've been working on that.
Yeah.
And so that's still very much in my brain. And I have several other exhibition projects coming up at the Nasher. With ARP completed, I'm also thinking about sort of the next big historical thing, because they do take a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm actually kind of playing around with the idea of returning to or turning to this kind of Abex, Neo-Dada period in America's history. So that remains to be seen,
yes.
But that's sort of I need ARP to slowly exit my brain.
I can only imagine how much space such a project takes up in one's brain. Well, actually, that just the thought of being in charge of taking an exhibition from one space to another, I was interested in. So this is really the last question. as a curator, when you're working with a particular space, so there's the Nasher, which obviously has a particular nature and the architecture by Renzo Piano and so forth. But I know that in the case of, for example, the Nasher Exchange, you've worked with artists to on kind of site specific work elsewhere in Dallas, and I just wanted to ask how you think about the space that you're working with, especially I guess in the case of sculpture, where it's not just you're not just thinking about the walls, but you're really thinking about the space. How do you kind of approach that challenge when you're thinking about how to put work into a space?
I'm not sure how I approach it. Hopefully there is a model or a floor plan. I mean, the best thing is to be able to go into the space proper.
Yeah.
And I think a lot and talk to myself.
Yeah.
Yeah. What we do at the Nasher, we're kind of old school in that we use models.
Yes. Yeah.
There are software programs that you can also use for this. But especially since it's sculpture, I find it useful to have the kind of 3D thing lying out there, laying it out. And that's what I've been doing for Peggy Guggenheim installation, because it's 11 small rooms as opposed to the Nasher's larger spaces. And you just start moving. You have to do, that's kind of what it comes down to. You have to just start, if you're working with a model, you just have to start moving things around and see what works.
Yeah.
And it was much easier for me to do that once we had the show installed at the Nasher, because I knew how much space things really took up.
Yeah.
The thing that was, the thing that's very daunting about a show like ARP is a number of works in the show had couriers, and when couriers come, they supervise the installation of the work, which means you can't tweak it afterwards. So we had to really see that, I had to be sure at the very beginning that all the pedestals were in exactly the right place, and as much as I could where everything else, you know, was going to hang on the walls and so forth. When you're working with contemporary artists, it's a little bit different.
Right.
Because there does tend to be more flexibility, which is good.
Yeah.
If it's new work, there can always be things that you don't foresee, which also happens with older work as well.
Yeah.
And that was one thing that was interesting with the Melvin Edwards show, because it traveled to two other museums, and in both places we reconfigured the barbed wire pieces differently.
Right.
And in those cases, it was mainly him coming in and talking with the curator and with me about where various pieces, where they could go or how we could reconfigure them to meet the needs of that space. Wow. But I really enjoy that. It's a little nerve-wracking until you know how it's all going to fit, but it's really great.
Wow. Well, our guest today is Catherine Kraft, who's curator most recently of The Nature of ARP, which will open at the Peggy Guggenheim Collection in Venice in April. And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, produced by Creative Disturbance. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.